So welcome. Good afternoon. Hope you're doing well. My name is Todd Presner. I'm the director of the UCLA Alan D. Levy Center for Jewish Studies. It's a great privilege to welcome Professor Robert Alter to deliver our annual Arnold Band Lecture in Jewish Studies. As many of you know, and perhaps I know some of you were there last year, the lecture series honors the distinguished work and career of Arnold Band, Professor Emeritus of Hebrew and Comparative Literature here at UCLA, and founder of our Center for Jewish Studies in 1994, and also founding director of our Center for Israel Studies. The lecture today has been made possible by a generous endowment from one of his students, Milt Hyman, and his wife Sheila. They cannot be with us today, but their generosity and their vision for making this lecture series possible is something that I do want to recognize. So I want to thank Milt and Sheila Hyman for that. I do want to say that today's lecture is sponsored by a number of units at UCLA, including the Department of Slavic, East European and Eurasian Languages and Cultures, as well as the Department of Comparative Literature. And want to acknowledge the staff at the Levy Center, in particular Chelsea White, for all of the handling of the event today. It's wonderful to see so many of you here today, and it's certainly a testament to the opportunity that we have to hear from Robert Alter. Alter is professor of Hebrew and class of 1937, professor of comparative literature at the University of California, Berkeley, where he's taught since 1962. He's perhaps best known to many of us for his Bible translations, his scholarly interpretations and commentaries, which have, without exaggeration, transformed the field of biblical studies. At Berkeley, he teaches a wide range of courses on 19th century European and American, and the European and American novel, on modernism, on literary aspects of the Bible, as well as writes extensively on modern Hebrew literature. He's published 25 books, ranging from critical biographies to literary theory, to most recently volumes of biblical translation accompanied by commentary, including the Book of Psalms and the Wisdom books. Among his range of works is a recent book, which I particularly love, called Imagined Cities, which came out of Yale University Press in 2005, and is really a testament to the range of his interests in representation, questions of modernism, and the literary imagination. Alter's translations of the Hebrew Bible have received widespread acclaim, and the Five Books of Moses won, many of you know, the Penn and Translation Award. Oops. I think we're okay. A recent book called The Pen of Iron, American Prose and the King James Bible was published by Princeton University Press in 2010, and his most recent volume of Bible translation and commentary is Stronger Than Death Is Love, The Song of Songs, Ruth, Esther, Jonah, and Daniel. In 2009, he received the Robert Kirsch Award from the Los Angeles Times for a lifetime contribution to American letters. He's a fellow at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the American Philosophical Society, as well as the recipient of four honorary degrees, as well as prizes, including that from the American Council of Learned Societies. It's truly a great honor to welcome Professor Alter here to give the annual distinguished lecture in Jewish studies in the name of Professor Arnold Band. Today's lecture is entitled Anti-Prophecy in the Poetry of Chaim Bialik. So without further ado, I turn it over to you. Thank you so much.
This is so you know that I'm me. I have to say that it's especially meaningful for me to be delivering the Arnold Band lecture because he and I made a connection very early in my career, which I'll explain just for a minute or two. When I arrived at Harvard to begin my graduate work in comparative literature at the tender age of 22, I was going to major in comp lit in English literature and do French and Hebrew. There was, of course, nobody at Harvard to study Hebrew with. And Arne was finishing his PhD. I think he's about 4 or 5 years older than I. And his major literature had been classical Greek, but he also had this passionate interest in Hebrew. So he heard that I arrived. He invited me to dinner at his home, and he explained to me all the ins and outs of negotiating the graduate program in comparative literature, some of which I took on board and some of which I blithely ignored, but I got through anyway. And when he finished his degree, I was, of course, still working on mine. He came directly to UCLA and created a serious program in Hebrew literature. When I finished my degree, I went to the English department at Columbia, where I had done my undergraduate work. And on the side, somewhat to the disapproval of my senior colleagues in the English department, I was writing articles on modern Hebrew literature. And that brought me to the attention of comparative literature at Berkeley, which was then a new department. And they made me an offer I couldn't refuse. So I've been out at Berkeley ever since, and by this kind of odd combination of circumstances, Arne and I, who first connected in Cambridge, Massachusetts, really built the two serious programs in Hebrew literature in the country on the west coast of California. So that's why it feels especially good for me to do this. I noticed, by the way, when I read the program, that summary I sent in of my talk was really too good. That is, you now know everything I'm going to say, and you can all go out to the clubs. But maybe the details will be interesting. So, a poet as a prophet, you might think offhand that it would be the most natural thing for a Hebrew poet to assume this stance. After all, in the case of Bialik, I strongly suspect that he knew all of the prophets by heart, or very close to by heart, and probably the whole Tanakh, the whole Hebrew Bible, pretty much by heart. And he had so internalized it that although this is not the only Hebrew style he used, he could write a poem of 60-some-odd lines, like the one we're going to look at, in perfect biblical Hebrew. Isaiah, the son of Amoz, would have had no difficulty understanding Bialik's poem, Davar, Word. Or even at a greater length, a couple of years before the composition of Word, he wrote a stunning mythological poem called The Desert Dead. And that's about 900,000 lines long. And maybe there are three words in the whole poem that are post-biblical Hebrew. So he could write in that Hebrew. He knew these texts, the biblical texts. So of course he would assume the role of a prophet. But the "of course" is not very accurate, because when you look across at what his contemporaries and predecessors in Hebrew literature were doing, you don't find very much evidence of this stance of the poet as prophet. To take the example of his great contemporary, a poet that I'm a big fan of, Shaul Chernyakhovsky. Chernyakhovsky, like Bialik, was a trenchant castigator of the Jewish people. But he never did it in the pose of a prophet. Well, you might say, those of you who know Chernyakhovsky, well, he wouldn't, because he was a neo-pagan. But he could have very well adopted the stance of a prophet of Baal or a prophet of Ashtoreth, but he never did that. But Bialik, on the other hand, often, I don't say invariably, but often pursued this stance of the prophet. I think where he got it from was a poem by Pushkin, the commanding Russian poet of the 19th century, and it's a poem that is kind of super canonical in Russian culture. Every school child knows it. So, in part, what I'm going to do this afternoon is a tracing of the interesting things that happen in cross-breeding among literatures. That is, the trajectory is going to go from Isaiah to Pushkin to Bialik. It sounds like a triple play combination. Okay, so let's begin. We're going to be reading a lot of text in the next few minutes with Isaiah 6. Now, this is my translation. It's a draft translation. And this, together with all the other prophets and the rest of the Hebrew Bible, will be available in print in about a year and a half. In the year of the death of King Uzziah, I saw the Master seated on a high and lofty throne, and the skirts of his robe filled the temple. Seraphim were stationed over him, six wings for each one. With two it would cover its face, and with two it would cover its feet, and with two it would hover. And each called out to each and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of armies. The fullness of all the earth is his glory." And the pillars of the threshold swayed from the voice calling out, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe to me, for I am undone, for I am a man of impure lips, and in the people of impure lips do I dwell. My eyes have seen the King, Lord of armies." I'll stop there for a moment. This is Isaiah's dedication scene. And though it's the sixth chapter in the ordering of the book that we have, clearly it's where his mission as a prophet begins. And in terms of Bialik's thematics, I think what's particularly salient here is the notion of unclean lips. That is, in Hebrew, well, lips are sfataim, that's the dubitative form, but the singular is safa, lip, but that also means language. And this is an issue that preoccupied Bialik. He wrote a number of important poems about it, that language could be compromised, language could be subverted, or to use maybe the most relevant term for Bialik, language could be contaminated, and then it would lose all its validity, and you couldn't write Hebrew poetry in it. So this notion that Isaiah in the 7th century BCE articulates, that his lips are impure and he lives in among a people of impure lips, is very directly relevant to Bialik. Now, just a bit more. "And one of the seraphim came down to me, in his hand a glowing coal and tongues that he had taken from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, 'Look, this has touched your lips, and your crime is gone, your offense shall be atoned.'" So this is the rite of purification. In a minute we'll see the astounding thing that Pushkin does with this. "And I heard the voice of the Master saying, 'Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?' And I said, 'Here I am, send me.' And he said, 'Go and say to the people, indeed you must hear, but you will not understand. Indeed you must see, but you will not know. Make the heart of this people obtuse, and block its ears and seal its eyes, lest it see with its eyes and with its ears hear, and its heart understand, and it turn back and be healed.' And I said, till when, O Master? And he said, till towns are laid waste with no dwellers and homes with no men. And the land is laid waste to desolation. Okay, this is a very peculiar moment in a dedication scene for a prophet, because what the prophet or God speaking through the prophet seems to anticipate is that the prophetic mission will be a failure. And we all know that the biblical prophets enunciated great and reverberant words, but did they convince anybody? And Isaiah, at the beginning of his mission, knows he really isn't going to be able to convince anybody. This, again, will play out in the Bialik poem, but it will play out with a kind of extreme transformation. Okay, now let us move on to Pushkin's poem, The Prophet. I want to say this, I don't know Russian, but Pushkin, because it was a biblical topic, it's his take on Isaiah 6. And for those who are familiar with it, I wanted everybody to have Isaiah 6 very fresh in their minds. Pushkin composed the poem with a strong coloration of old church Slavonic. That is, it wasn't normal 19th century Russian. And various English translators have tried to produce an equivalent, and usually it sounds rather fake and a little phony. This translation maybe is a little less offensive than some of the others. And by the way, I won't read it, but for those of you who do read Hebrew, I've reproduced a Hebrew translation of Pushkin's The Prophet. It's called Hanavi, by David Fishman, who was Bialik's contemporary, operating mainly out of Warsaw. Bialik operated mainly out of Odessa. And it's a much better translation. If you read Hebrew, you could follow it in the Fishman. And there's an obvious reason why it's a better translation. At the beginning of the 20th century, you could compose a perfectly viable poem in biblical Hebrew, which is an excellent equivalent of Old Church Slavonic, whereas it gets corny when you try to do this in English, especially now. But anyway, I want you to be able to follow what goes on in the Pushkin poem before we turn to Bialik. I went with a soul athirst for grace amid a darkling desert land. At a crossing of the ways, beheld a six-winged seraph stand with fingers light as dreams at night. He brushed mine eyes and they grew bright, opening onto prophecies wild as a startled eaglet's eyes. He touched and filled my mortal ears with all the sounding of the spheres. I heard the shudders of the sky, the sweep of angel hosts on high, the creep of beasts below in the seas, the seep of sap in valley trees. Okay, I'm going to stop there for a minute. Something has happened to Isaiah's dedication scene, clearly, and more things are going to happen in the second half of this short poem. First, the experience is a cosmic experience. He hears the music of the spheres. It's also an experience of nature. That is, he hears what's going on in the earth. He hears the language of of all the beasts of the earth, and even the sap percolating through the trees. So this becomes a transposition of the idea of biblical prophecy into a notion of the romantic poet, a romantic with a capital R. That is the poet who is in touch with the profundity and the sublimity of nature and with the cosmos. That's not a bad thumbnail definition of the romantic poet. Obviously, there are other very different kinds of poets. So, Pushkin continues. And leaning to my lips, he wrung thereout my slithering, sinful tongue. So we have a stepping up of the idea of impure lips in Isaiah. It's a slithering, impure tongue. It's like the serpent in the garden story. And something else happens. Instead of the rite of purification, R-I-T-E, of course, we have a kind of violence perpetrated on the prophet poet. That is, in order to become a poet, he has to have his filthy, lying tongue ripped out from his mouth, and then it gets still more violent. In through my wasting lips, and with his right hand bloodied wet, in through my wasting lips, he set a serpent's wise and forked sting. And with his sword he cleft my chest and reft my quaking heart out whole, and thrust inside my sundered breast a blazing shard of living coal. There in the desert I lay dead until the voice from heaven said, "Arise, O prophet, work my will that thou hast now perceived and heard. On land and sea thy charge fulfill and burn man's heart with this my word." So the notion that the poet prophet has a higher calling to inflame the hearts of humankind, that's pretty much in keeping with the biblical notion of prophecy. Of course, what's different is that the burning coal from the altar in Isaiah 6, which is just an instrument of purification, that a very hot instrument that the seraph, who has to use tongues, he can't hold it in his own seraphic hands or wings. That's an instrument of purification. Whereas here, we have an extreme act of violence. The heart of the poet is torn out, and the burning coal is substituted as his heart. Now, apart from that, we now have an aspect of violence in the dedication of the prophet poet that we don't have in Isaiah. What the image suggests is that in order to become a poet, and I would add a romantic poet, a person has to go a radical and even painful transformation. He can't work with an ordinary human heart. He has to have a glowing coal inside his chest, which will inspire his language, and his language will then set on fire the hearts of humankind. Well, this is a very imposing and I suppose impossible ideal. And part of Bialik's problem is maybe that he took it too seriously. That is, Bialik embraced this ideal, and then the ideal failed. So with that, and I'm going to be concentrating now on the Bialik poem. In 1904, when he was actually briefly in Warsaw because the headquarters of the magazine for which he was literary editor had temporarily moved to Warsaw. He composed this poem. This translation is mine, so I take full responsibility for any faults. The English title doesn't quite do it. The English has Word, which we think of that as a word processing program that we all use. In fact, I had to give special instructions to my computer so it wouldn't think that I was looking for the program word every time I wanted to get this text. Anyway, Word means, in the Hebrew, is davar. Now, davar is the classical biblical word for word. Later, in late biblical, it's substituted by milah, which becomes the modern Hebrew word, the term for word. But it has a particular prophetic association. Vayihi devar Adonai Eli. And the word of the Lord came to me saying. So that's the kind of davar that he's talking about. I might say this. Maybe what I'll do is, I'll, since it's a longish poem, I will read a section of lines and comment, and then we'll move on to another section of lines. Now, one recent critic has said, well, this poem was composed just a few months after Herzl died of a sudden heart attack in his late 40s, and that explains the mood of despair. I think that's a little simplistic. Herzl's death contributes in some peripheral way to the darkness of the vision. But I don't think at all that that's what the poem is about. So, let us begin. I'll tell you what I want to do first. I won't inflict too much of this, but since it is poetry, let me read the first 15 lines or so in the Hebrew. Now, unusually for Bialik, this is free verse, but it's free verse composed not in Hebrew the way we pronounce it now. So in reading it, to do justice to Bialik's intention as a poet, I'll try to give some approximation of the way he would have pronounced it. Et rispas ha'esh me'al mizbechoz re'holo hanovi v'netashto lanavolim. Tehilohem lisloso lehatzilyom velishbos sirom ula hochem kafyodom v'yasanitzos milvov chozrei v'hilamo lahatzis glumaktores asher befihem ula ha'ir al schok hazodon ha'orev kagonov tachasvosom v'al hatzdiyo asher b'einehem, hineihem holchim anavolem, hineihem boim v'atfilo asher limadetam alashonom, kovim es machovcho u'mekavim tekvoscho v'nafshom al harisos mizbachacho yiso. It sounds something like that anyway. Okay, now, let's, for now, there is this concept in the Talmud called Inui Tzibur, which means torturing the audience. I don't want to do that anymore, so let's begin it. Okay. Fling away the fiery coal from your altar, O prophet, and leave it to the scum Let them have it to roast over it their meat and to heat up their pots and to warm their hands. And the spark from your heart scatter, and let them have it to light the tobacco that they smoke and to cast light on the vicious smile lurking like a thief beneath their mustache and on the cunning in their eyes. Look, they are going, the scum. Look, they are coming with the prayer that you taught them on their tongue, aching with your pain and sharing your hopes, but longing for the wreck of your altar. And then they pounce on the wreck and poke through the pile of its collapse and pull out its shattered stones and sink them into the floor of their house and their garden wall and headstones on graves they set up. I'm going to stop at the comma there, because the poem is almost one long, magnificent run-on sentence. I want to comment on one Hebrew phrase, because it tells us something about the aim of this poem. The word that I translate, it's actually two words in the as tobacco in line 6, is glom haktoret. Now, my dear late friend Binyamin Hashav, in a footnote to it's his text that those of you who can follow it in the Hebrew have in front of you, he translated it as mikteret, pipe. But I don't think it's... Now, mikteret is the modern Hebrew word for pipe to this day. But the phrase that Bialik uses is glom haktoret. Now, glom is a kind of bunch or a mass or a shapeless chunk. So I think it's the chunk of tobacco that's put into the pipe. But why does he do this? Well, firstly, he doesn't, God forbid, want to use in this very biblicizing poem a word like tabak, which of course had pretty early currency in Hebrew. But there's something else. Although mikteret was already beginning to be... Oh, I should explain this. Mikteret is a noun which is built on the Hebrew root that means to burn incense. Ketoret is incense. So... literally, this phrase that Bialik uses, the chunk of incense, glom haktoret. But of course, every reader understands he's talking about tobacco. So why does he do this? Because ketoret is a very pure biblical word. When I say pure, I mean that its context is cultic. You have to have pure ketoret, pure incense, to burn on the altar. And it is strictly connected with the realm of the sacred. So by coining a phrase, glom haktoret, that means tobacco, in a single phrase he packs in the idea of the profanation of the sacred, which is what this readership is all about. Now, back in the mid-20th century, one of the influential Hebrew critics of the time, Baruch Kurzweil, in writing about Bialik, coined a phrase. He said that Bialik is I'll translate this in a moment, shaliach lelo sholeach, an emissary without anyone to send him. In other words, he no longer has the belief in a God who sends prophets. And that's why there's such anguish in his prophetic poems. But I do not see, with the partial exception of a couple of lines which we'll be reading presently, I don't see much emphasis in this poem on the sholeach, on the divine sender of the emissary. the problem for Bialik is the audience. For those of you who are not familiar with Bialik's career, he began publishing in the 1890s. In the first few years of the 20th century, he was a flaming meteor. I mean, he produced one great poem after another, including these four poemas, as they're called from the Russian, these long quasi-narrative poems in the City of Slaughter, the Pond, and a couple of others. He was at the height of his poetic powers. By 1907, 1908, 1909, he was beginning not to write poetry. And then he pretty much stopped. But it wasn't out of a writer's block. How do I know this? Because from time to time, down through once every few years, down into the late 1920s, he would produce a poem. And that the poem that he would produce had the same imaginative power and verbal virtuosity of Bialik at his greatest. So there was something else that was inhibiting him from writing. And I think you see the beginning of the so-called silence of Bialik in this poem. And the problem is not the absence of a sender of the prophet. The problem is the audience. That is, these people, as Isaiah said, are not really listening to him. But he pushes Isaiah one step further. It's not just that they can't understand what he's saying, but they are perverting what he's saying. They distort it, and they use it for their own base purposes, like the ketoret, the sacred incense, which becomes a pipe tobacco, and of course. Line 10, I hope everybody sees, the prayer that you taught them on their tongue, acting with your pain and sharing your hopes, is bitterly sarcastic. That is, you taught them with your poems to aspire to noble things, presumably in terms of the national rebirth. But they turn this into triviality. Okay, let's pick it up now. Now, we got as far as... I'll pick it up again at line 15. So they take the wreck of the altar and sink them into the floor of their house and their garden wall and headstones on graves they set up. Now, a cemetery, you could say, is a sacred place, but he had hoped that his poetry would have something to do with the renewal of life, especially with the renewal of national life. And the Hebrew term for renaissance, rebirth, renewal is tchia, which really means something like resurrection. And that is not what happened. They dragged off these pieces of the altar and set them in cemeteries. And should they find in its shards your charred heart? Now, here you can see the Pushkin presence. That is, the heart doesn't get charred in Isaiah. In Pushkin, the heart gets ripped out and a burning coal is placed in its stead. And in Bialik, the heart itself is burnt away through the anguish that the poet has suffered. they would, and should they find in its shards your charred heart, they would throw it to their dogs. So kick over your altar, kick with a shameful foot, and let it crumble with its fire and its smoke. And you shall wipe away with a single swipe the spider web that stretched into violin strings in your heart, and you wove from it a song of rebirth and a vision of salvation, a false burden and deceit to the ears. I find the language of this poem utterly amazing. I hope even in translation some of you do. Here you have an image which is basically an oxymoron. It's a contradiction in terms. The violin strings, and the word for violin is also the lyre, the biblical lyre that King David plays, and that was played by the choristers in the ancient temple. So you have these beautifully stretched gut strings that when played on emit melodious sound. But Bialik says, in a radical moment of self-doubt about his own poetry, he says, they weren't violin strings all along. They were the threads of a spider's web, kind of nasty and insubstantial. And so what he's feeling, and that's why you can see what I think the despair in this poem is all about the audience. That when I see what they've made of my poems, the speaker of this poem says, I see that I was deluded into thinking they were violin strings singing a song of rebirth. They were nothing but spider webs. And fling it to the wind. These are the strands of the spider web. And let it float away torn and pure white in space on a bright late summer day, that no silver thread shall find its mate and no strand its counterpart, and on the first cloudy day they shall vanish. That is, poetry is all about integration of formal elements into a structure of luminous meaning. That is, the sound patterns, the meaning of the words, the form of the poem. And here the opposite happens. You have these strands of spider webs blown away in the wind. And on the first cloudy day they shall vanish. And your hammer, the iron hammer that broke from all the pounding, I'm sorry, that broke from all the pounding on hearts of stone to no avail, you shall break piece by piece and grind it into a spade and dig us a grave. Okay, I'll pause at that comma. Now, the entire Hebrew Bible is so alive in Bialik's imagination that he can scarcely take a step without invoking texts, but as a great poet will do, transforming them. So the hammer, the pounding hammer, is from Jeremiah. Hine dvari kapatish yifot tzetzela. Look, my word is like a hammer pounding a rock. So that's where the origins of that. But then he turns that rock into something else. And now we move from Jeremiah to Ezekiel. That is, Ezekiel talks about replacing Lev Ha'Evan, the heart of stone, with Lev Basar, a heart of flesh. But there are only hearts of stone to pound on in the readership he sees before him. And let's remember, so Bialik was certainly aware of this, that heart in biblical Hebrew is not merely an organ of feeling, as you know, St. Valentine's Day and all that, but it's the seat of understanding. They thought that intellection took place through the heart. So these people do not understand like the predicted audience of Isaiah's prophecies. And who would put God's wrath in your mouth? Him shall you curse, and let not your lip tremble, and let your word be more bitter than death. Let it be death itself. We shall hear it and shall know. See, the profusion of night enfolds us. Darkness swarms around us, and we grope like the blind. Something has happened among us, and no one knows what it is. No one sees, no one tells whether the sun has dawned for us or set, or whether it has set for all time. Now, here there may be at least an oblique relevance of Herzl. That is, this is 1904, it's just 7 years after the founding of the Zionist movement. And of course there were great hopes that again we were going to live as a nation, we were going to return to our land and so forth. And that's the dawning part. Perhaps this is dawn. But no, he moves quickly from dawn to an eternal sunset, which, in other words, is apocalypse. And chaos is great all around, and fearsome around is the chaos, and there is no escape. And should we cry out in the dark, should we pray, whose ear would hear? And should we utter the cruel curse of God, on whose head would it fall? And should we grind our teeth and clench wrathful fists, on whose skull would it come down? By the verb grind reminds me of something I needed to say, that in the lines above, which we just considered, with a line 31, you shall break the hammer piece by piece and grind it into a spade. That, as I'm sure many of you will have recognized, but for those of you who didn't, it is another twisting reversal of a prophetic text. This is the famous passage in Isaiah, and you shall grind your swords into plowshares. And the same Hebrew verb, l'chatet, is used both there in Isaiah and here. Okay, back to line 51. All of them chaos swallows, the wind bears away. I think there's a piece of self-quotation here, yes, which poets do all the time. That is, there's an early, quite famous poem by Bialik in which he finds himself the last person left in an abandoned Beit Midrash, in an abandoned study house. There's this resonant line, which is, Kulam nasa haruach, kulam sachaf aor. Thank you. All of them, the wind bore off. All of them, the light swept away. Well, you can see what he's done with that line here. That is, he's eliminated light. And light in Levadi, that early poem, probably means enlightenment, European culture, while he's remaining in the Beit Midrash. Whereas here, it's all of them chaos, and then a more violent verb than he uses in the earlier poem, swallows. The wind bears away. And the triple insistence on chaos, tohu, brings us back of course, to the beginning of Genesis, the tohu vavohu at the beginning of Genesis. And apocalypse is nothing if not a reversal of the process of creation. You start off with chaos, emptiness, and you end up with created things, with order, with kinds of being, and now it's going back the other way. And there is nowhere to lean. All power is gone, and there is no way. And the heavens are silent. They know what they have sinned against us. An abyss they have sinned. And in stillness they bear their crime. So these three lines, I think, are the only ones in which we come a little closer to Kurzweil's formulation of the sender without anybody who has sent him. That is a kind of coordinate of the what he finds to be the ghastly and destructive behavior of the world of Jews that he tried to address in his poetry, is the fact that there is no divine intervention. If there is a God, then God just lets the Jewish people destroy itself. Okay, let's move on to the end of the poem. Open your mouth then, prophet of the end. So here, the prophet, Hanavi, which he picked up from Pushkin, has become, through the elegant defining power of the construct form smichut, for those who know Hebrew, in Hebrew, he's become not Hanavi, but Nevi Haketz, the prophet of the end. A prophet not bringing a message of change and renewal, but an apocalyptic message. Open your mouth then, prophet of the end, and if there be a word with you, say it, though it be bitter as death, though it be death itself, say it. Why should we fear death when its angel rides on our shoulders, his bit between our teeth, and with a shout of rebirth on our lips, and with celebrants' jubilation, we shall skip to the grave? So the angels of Isaiah 6 were fluttering in the air in the temple space with those amazing six wings, now become sort of cruel riders riding on the back of these people on all four, pulling the reins and jerking the bit and directing them to go hopping to the grave. So it is, I guess I have not brought a message of hope to this audience in reading this poem with you. A kind of curious thing where Bialik in 1904 makes contact, I think coincidentally, not by any kind of influence, with the new currents of European literature, which would soon get the designation modernism. That is, Bialik is basically a romantic poet after his time. His sense of nature is that of a romantic poet. Nature is this luminous living entity that speaks to the poet the way the woods speak to Wordsworth. And I'm thinking of poems, for those who know Bialik in the Hebrew, like Habrecha, the pond, Tzafririm, mourning spirits, that's kind of hard to translate, Zohar. The forms of Bialik's poetry are rather old-fashioned in 1904. That is, for the most part, he used rhyming stanzaic forms, which maybe were a little more congenial in the Russian setting than they would have been in England and America in 1904. Or usually you don't find, say, the kind of startling, abrasive, disorienting use of imagery that the modernist poets were cultivating. Remember, just 3 or 4 years after this poem was written, T.S. Eliot wrote Prufrock, which exhibits all those features that I just spelled out. So he's a traditionalist, he's a romantic. You can see that as a romantic poet, that Pushkin would especially appeal to him. But when he gets to writing Davar, in a way he puts that all behind him. I would say not only thematically, but formally. That is, this is the first poem that Bialik wrote that was neither stanzaic or hexameters like the Desert Dead, or other kinds of long metered rhymes in the other poemas, but it's free verse. And so in renouncing the mission of the romantic prophet poet, he also had to break with the formal constraints of romantic poetry. And the theme is also very modernist. That is, this is not the whole story about modernism. Modernism contains a powerful celebratory element in some writers. Like, you know, think of the end of James Joyce's Ulysses, where in Molly's soliloquy, yes, she said, yes, 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 affirming life, affirming procreation, affirming beauty, and so forth. But as we're all aware, there is this dark and despairing side of modernism, of which maybe Kafka is the best illustration. In the American setting, it would be Faulkner, who began his writing career about a decade after the composition of this poem. And even the theme of silence is a modernist theme. That is, you get it in Samuel Beckett, who was kind of a second generation modernist. You get it still closer to our own time in some of the poetry of Paul Celan. And so through the inner logic of Bialik's own poetic enterprise, he comes without looking over his shoulder at what other writers were beginning to go. He comes to sound these modernist themes of chaos, apocalypse, encroaching death, and the necessity for silence. So it's I think a stunning exhibition of supreme poetic power marshaled to express a despair about the justification for poetry. It's not a feel-good message to take away, but I think it's a central truth of the poetry of Bialik. Thank you. Now, I'm happy to answer some questions. I don't know how good the acoustics in this room are. I can guarantee you that my hearing isn't that good. So whoever speaks up, please speak loud and clear. Yes.
I visited Odessa, and I find it very cluttered, and the world that Bialik lived in was like New York in a period that wasn't beautiful. How do you get such beautiful poetry in a setting that isn't?
Okay. Bialik grew up in a little shtetl, Russian shtetl. When he was in his mid-teens, he went to the famous yeshiva in Lithuania in Volozhin, which sometimes I think of, if you know French culture, like the École Normale Supérieure of Eastern European Orthodox Jewry. But like quite a few of the students there, inside his big folio volume of the Talmud, he was reading forbidden literature, mostly Hebrew journals and Hebrew poems and so forth, and yearning to be a poet. And then he made his way to Odessa. Now, I have to explain a couple of things about Odessa. At the end of the 18th century, is what in Israel would be called an Ir Pituach, a development city. There was no city in Odessa. And the Tsar decided, in order to put down stakes for the empire on its eastern flank, to create a port city there. Now, because it was a new city, there were no restrictions on Jewish residency in the city, because they wanted to encourage whoever could to come to the city. So it wasn't like Moscow or St. Petersburg, where a Jew had to have a special permit to live there. Most of the Jews live within the pale of settlement. It was also kind of a Wild West place, except it was the Wild East. It was bustling. It might not have been very. I've never been there, but I've read a lot about it. It was bustling with energy, probably not very pretty. Part of the energy was criminal. Those of you who know the stories of Isaac Babel know that the underworld was dominated by Jews around Bialik's time. Centers, publishing houses, and centers of Hebrew and Yiddish publication rapidly developed in Odessa. Orthodox Jews had this saying that for 400 versts, you know, this Russian measurement in each direction around Odessa, hellfire is burning, because there were a lot of secular Jews. So there was a terrific amount of synergy in the Jewish community of Odessa. You know, Chernichovsky came from a little village, not a shtetl, in the Ukraine, and he also took up residence in Odessa. So there was poets and novelists and critics talking to each other all the time, meeting each other over dinner and so forth. And then there was the journals. That is, in the 1890s, Achad Ha'am, the ideologue of so-called spiritual or cultural Zionism, created a journal called HaShiloach, and that was the major literary intellectual journal in Hebrew for at least 15, 20 years. So I think that there was a terrific amount of stimulus for Bialik to write poetry when he moved to Odessa. That's a good question.
Thank you. Yeah. At what year did Chernyakhovsky and Bialik, Hanan didn't come to Israel?
He visited,
yeah. But he didn't come, he didn't live there. However, Chernyakhovsky and Bialik
okay.
did. At what year did they museum to Palestine?
Okay, here's the tricky thing. And it's true not only of Bialik and Chernyakhovsky. They were both dedicated, I think, very sincere Zionists. They were also deeply rooted in European culture. That is, Bialik knew nothing of European culture until he was 15 or so, then he taught himself Russian and he learned German and so on and so on. With Chernyakhovsky, it's another story because he knew about 10 languages very well. I think that had it not, this may be a shocking thing to say, had it not been for the Russian Revolution, they might not have ended up going to the land of Israel. What happened was this. For about 2 or 3 years, maybe 4 years, after the Russian Revolution, it was still okay to write Hebrew in the Soviet Union. And of course, in the early 20s, Habima, as a Hebrew theater, was founded in Moscow. But, and I have seen with my own eyes, because Harvard has a very good, when I was a graduate student, has a very good library, two literary miscellanies in Hebrew were published in the Soviet Union in the early 1920s. One of them might have been called Reshit or Breshit, and it has a classic Soviet illustration on the cover of a worker of the world breaking his chains. And it's all Hebrew, and it's all pro-revolution. But certainly by around 1923-24, I can't give you the exact date, Hebrew had become very suspect to the Soviet authorities. And then they declared it a counter-revolutionary language. So it was not safe to write Hebrew and stay in the Soviet Union. Several Hebrew writers were able to get exit visas through the intervention of Maxim Gorky, who had connections in the Soviet bureaucracy. But neither Bialik nor Chernyakhovsky went directly to Israel. They went to Germany and stayed there for a few years. So in principle, they wanted to move to Israel, but they weren't in a big hurry to do it. And my memory fails me here slightly, which came first, I think Bialik, but like late 1920s, early 1930s would have been when they, well, maybe late 1920s when they came.
26.
Oh, thank you, yeah. Now, of course, once they came, they did become ensconced in the emerging Hebrew culture of Palestine. Chernyakhovsky was a medical doctor, so he worked. He worked as a school doctor, and I have run into elderly Israelis who remember Dr. Shaul coming to school to give them their checkouts. Yeah, with his big bushy hair. See, we have a bushy-haired poet and a bald poet. I'll let the rest of you think about what the implications of that are. And they became very much part of the literary life of the country.
So basically, they came at the same time that there was a movement of a bima to move to Israel.
Yes, that's right. I think the story about Habima, I believe this is 1925-1926. Yeah. Habima went on an international tour. They came to the United States. And then wisely, they never went back to the Soviet Union. Yes. They would have all been dead within a few years. They went to Palestine. Yes. There's somebody I can't hear. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Toda rabba. Three short points. The first one, the article of Achad HaAv that you mentioned at the end, 1893, Kohen VeNavi, this is the description of the Navi. The Navi is a messenger without a sender.
Yeah.
So it goes to Baruch Kurzweil and so on and so forth. The second is Chose Lech Brach, Lo Meshorer, Lo Navi. This is Amos.
Yes, of course, right.
Just a major influence on the poetry. But the third point is something different. And he wrote a book, he wrote a poem in 1902 in Yiddish.
Yeah, he rarely wrote in Yiddish.
Exactly. And the name of the poem is 1902, is Das letzte Wort. The last word. Exactly. And he says, in the first line he says, and I translate it, Ich bin zu hier von Gott geschickt. From God geschickt. God
said. Yeah, God said.
So, how do you look at it? I mean, how do you look at it as a metaphor or a talking device? But these questions, I mean, go all the way to 1923, that he said, Chose Lech Brach, starting with Chose Lech Brach. I mean, he already barach, ran away 20 years earlier, but still the same problems following. And I don't think with a solution, because it appears very late in this poetry. And the last thing in this, you mentioned about the shtika.
Yeah.
The shtika. In these 7 years, the silence. In these 7 years, he did write poetry. He worked with Ravnitsky.
So, about, he did lots of other things.
Exactly. No poetry. He wrote only 100 and some poetry, very few poems for such a great poet. But he worked with Ravnitsky, says Ravnitsky, and so on and so forth.
Okay, actually, you touched on a few points. I'll try to keep them all in mind. First, Achad HaAm's essay, Kohen VeNavi, Priest and Prophet. Now, Bialik was profoundly influenced by Achad HaAm and wrote one poem in tribute to him and considered himself a kind of disciple to him. I think Bialik embodied an order of originality that was transcended Achad HaAm. But part of the thrust of Achad HaAm's work was to take ideas, terms, roles that originally had theological and religious implications and to recast them to be acceptable for a modern secular cultural realm. And I'm sure that we probably should fill in here, at least as a footnote, that Achad HaAm in this respect is a kind of complement to Pushkin's poem. But eventually, as this poem illustrates, it didn't work. Now, I'm glad you mentioned other prophets, because In a way, the story of biblical prophecy, of which Bialik would have been keenly aware, is a story of anguish and repeated failure. The prophet Amos comes to the northern kingdom, and the priest says, "Chozeh lech brach lecha, get the hell out of here." I translate more or less literally. The prophet Jeremiah is hounded down by his contemporaries, and at least two occasions is imprisoned, and in one of them thrown into a dank, muddy pit. And he writes one prophetic poem in which he says to God, "You entice me, and I became enticed." Pitatani va'apap. "You're driving me crazy. You made my life one continuous misery. But I can't escape it because your word is like fire burning in my bones." So you can see all these biblical texts really resonate with Bialik, and I don't think that, as you yourself said, that there's a pat solution to whether he felt that there was a sender. Or whether he felt that he was sent, but there was no sender. I certainly think he felt there was no sender. But as time passed, it seems to me that the most agonizing thing for him was the audience. Yes?
I would say, as a play on that word, it's not a shaliach without a shaleach. It's a shaliach without a tzibul. That's why he could.
Yeah, exactly.
Who you're talking to.
Yeah.
He has a sholeach. He may hate the sholeach. He may be angry with the sholeach. There's an argument with the sholeach, but the sholeach is a sholeach. He knows who he is and who he is. The problem is the people he's speaking to have no clue.
That's absolutely true. But I guess we should add one thing, that if you pin me against a wall and said, what is Bialik's theology? I would have to give an evasive answer for the following reason, that I think it fluctuates. That is, probably after the age of 16, 17, 18, he no longer believed in God. But as you can see in a later example, you can no longer believe that of the poetry of Yehuda Amichai, whom, as some of you know, is very close to my heart. You can no longer believe in God, but as a poet, God hangs around and you can't get rid of him. So at times God is a sort of rhetorical device. At times God seems to be a presence that Bialik is angry with. At times he seems to be a divine figure who has lost all credibility, as in Be'ir HaHarega, when he says of God that Hu Yarad Min Chasav, he's gone bankrupt. Pardon me?
Very good way of putting it.
It just one has to accommodate all these, and of course there is one very painful expression, the short poem, not Be'ir HaHarega, that he wrote after the Kishinev massacre, when he said, "Shemaim bakshu rachamim alai im yesh bachem el v'lahem nativ v'ani lo mitzativ." Heavens ask mercy for me if there's a God in you and he has a path through you, but I haven't found him. Yes?
First of all, just a little correction. Somebody mentioned that he went to Israel, Palestine, Israel in 1926. It was 1924.
Yeah.
But he went via Warsaw, he went via Turkey and Germany. But my question is, when did he become a national poet? And what happened when he died? He died in Vienna, right, in 1934.
Right, because he was down there for medical treatment.
Oh, for medical, that's right.
Yeah, and he hadn't gone to Vienna to settle.
Yeah, but the Israel's national poet, when was that?
Oh, okay. I'm going to back up a step and offer an overview of the historical context of the early 20th century, especially for East European Jews, more so than for Jews to the West. The old system was breaking down. That is, in the 18th century, a young boy wouldn't have gone to one of the big yeshivas and ended up reading secular literature and breaking away. He would have spent several years at the yeshiva, got smicha, rabbinical ordination. If he was a brilliant Talmudist, he would find a rich householder who would marry his daughter off to him, and he would live with the Rockefeller Foundation support of the rich householder for a few years. Okay, but that was beginning to break up in the 20th century for reasons that would be another lecture. But what I would say is that around the turn of the 20th century, many Jews, obviously by no means all Jews, but especially Jews of an intellectual bent, which Bialik certainly had, were finding themselves, they didn't want to simply abandon their Jewish identity, which of course some people did, but they needed to renegotiate the terms. My late friend Benjamin Harshachem, I mentioned before, in a brilliant book that I strongly recommend to all of you called Language in Time of Revolution, makes this very shrewd observation that in 1897, the first Zionist Congress took place. The Vorwärts was founded in New York. The Bund was created as a movement. Freud began work on the interpretation of dreams, and I think he has a couple of other 1897 events. So all these are expressions of Jews moving in different directions, trying out something different that could express their Jewish identity. And I think in the case of Bialik, maybe his profound immersion in and love of the Hebrew language led him, A, to become, despite an occasional Yiddish poem, as you say, to become a Hebrew poet, not a Yiddish poet, and to think, especially with the emergence of Zionism, as Zionist nationalism as the vehicle for a renewal of Jewish existence. So on one foot, as we say in Hebrew, that's the best answer I could give to that. Yes?
I don't know much about Bialik. I've done some background research, but one poem that I've been involved with is called either Conductor of the Dance or The Dance of Death.
It's called what?
Conductor of the Dance or The Dance of Death.
Yes.
And I think it's an early poem. It was written both in Yiddish and Hebrew.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you would put it in the context of everything you've been talking about.
You know, well, now, the dance of death, and maybe after this I'll take two more questions. The dance of death, of course, is a motif of European folklore and the trend in European literature that's called Gothic. And it appealed to certain Hebrew writers in the early 20th century, including Agnon, by the way. That is one of Agnon wrote a few Yiddish stories when he was like about 16 years old before he switched definitively to Hebrew. One of the stories is Teutentanz, you know, dance of death. And in his Hebrew work, he came back to this theme a number of times. For example, there's a remarkable kind of spooky story by Agnon called Agadat HaSofer, the legend of the scribe, the Torah scribe. It's about an unconsummated marriage. That is, the scribe spends all his days poring over sheets of parchment and never turns to his wife. And then when she dies, he has this kind of... He makes a dress for a Torah scroll out of her wedding dress. And then he has this hallucination or dream, I forget which. It's Simchat Torah, and people are dancing, and he's dancing, but it's a Teutentanz, it's a dance of death. So the European motif in Bialik converges with his gloomy sense that the nation is being enveloped by death. So what is he takes a folklore motif that belongs to private life and combines it with a vision of national life. Now, I guess I need to throw in a little corrective here, and this goes back to what you said, that after, in Bialik's period of silence, he edited with Ravnitsky Sefer Agadah, this incredible compendium of rabbinic legend. He founded the publishing house Devir. He edited medieval Hebrew poetic texts and brought them out as books. You might say that he was a whirlwind of activity, and he certainly contributed to the renewal of Hebrew culture in Palestine, and which would later become Israel. So he, with all the gloom and doom, he was energetically committed to this project of national renaissance, and he made a difference in it. But what I would say is this, that some poetry is a little bit different from public activity, even public activity that involves a great deal of learning and high culture. And at times, a poet will permit himself to give vent in a poem to the deepest, darkest fears and doubts, which he doesn't let affect his activity as somebody who's part of a community. Okay, maybe just one more.
Yeah, a small question. I don't know much about Bialik's personal life. I know that he left his home in Tel Aviv to Israeli kids. It's supposed to be the home for all children.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know much about what he grew up with. Did he have sisters and brothers? Did he have a wife? Did he have kids?
Oh, okay. That's a legitimate question. I will give you a thumbnail summary. There's a new short biography out in this Yale series of Jewish biographies. Actually, it's a somewhat disappointing biography. I think it's rather flat and not at all, there's not much in terms of interpreting the poem, but at least it does give you the facts. So his father died when he was very young. He had siblings. Yeah, I don't know how close he was to his siblings. He was moved to the care of his grandfather, who was a very stern figure, and he's written about that a little bit. He was educated in the home shtetl, in a Beit Midrash, a study house, and then as an ilui, you know, a prodigy of learning, was sent off, as I said before, to the yeshiva at Volozhin. He did marry. He never had children. I don't know that that was a choice. I suspect that they couldn't. He and his wife were loyal to each other in their way. But I don't think it was altogether a close marriage. There were periods when they were living apart, where he was in one city and she was in another city. And there seems to be some evidence, not smoking gun, but some evidence that he had love affairs with probably at least two different women. When he came to Palestine, of course, he was feted by the community, and as I indicated before, he became a very active member of the cultural community, and was involved in these publishing enterprises. To round out the picture, I would also say this. You know, generations of poets tend to be rather Oedipal. They rebel against their predecessors. So what happened was that the poets who were born, say, about a quarter of a century after Bialik was born in 1873, I think, the most prominent among them was Avraham Shlonsky. They rejected Bialik. That they said, we don't need all this highfalutin biblicizing stuff. We want a poetry that stresses the experience of the new chalutz, the new Zionist pioneer. And their poetry was much more reflective of the formal procedures of early 20th century Russian poetry. And just to make you happy, and on this note I will conclude, that generation was dominant through the later 20s and 30s and into the early 40s. Bialik died in 34 and Chernyakhovsky in 43. But of course, not very long after the creation of the State of Israel, a new generation arose. And they said, Shlonsky and Altman and all, you know, they have these rhyming, chiming poems that are with words like none of the words that we speak. And so we had Yehuda Amichai and Natan Zach and another phase of Hebrew poetry. Thank you very much.